What's up, everybody? Welcome to We Have Cool Friends, the cool show. We interview our cool friends about the cool things they're doing. I'm Greg, and this is my cool friend, Sean Kittleston.
Hey, hello, Greg. Sean. Good to
how
see
are
you,
bud. It's good to see you. It's been way too long, you know what I mean? This pandemic and this busyness.
Probably wouldn't have been this long had it not been, but
yeah, probably.
Here we are. We're surviving we're gamers, and I think gamers are the most prepared people for
exactly.
Pandemic.
Well, this is exactly what we want to do. I want to be left alone in my house and just get to play games all the time.
Oh yeah, no, just tell me it's okay to be inside, and I'm like, oh, okay, all right, I'm inside.
Not only tell me it's okay to be inside, tell me I'm saving lives by being inside. I'm all about it. I got a hero complex.
The very first thing I ever published was a short story called Indoorsy.
Really?
Yeah. What was the name of the magazine now? It was in a really small, like indie print mag in New York. And I was so proud of it. It was me and a cartoonist named Cat Roberts.
Yeah.
And it was all about how when I was a kid, I didn't want to play outside with the other kids. My mom forced me to play with the other kids. And I went out with a glove. Like a monster glove that I stuck needles through to defend myself against bullying.
Jesus.
And sure enough, I got bullied and I like flashed him and scratched one of the kids like I was Catwoman in Batman Returns.
Wait, is this a true story, Sean?
Yes, this actually happened.
What the fuck is wrong with you? What kind of monster are you?
The thing, the other kids were like, oh my God, why are you doing this? Who the hell are you, dude? And I was not like a Batman. I was not cool about it. I would start crying. And I was like, I don't know. I was afraid of you guys, and now I'm afraid of me. Like,
yeah. I was the monster all along.
I was the monster. That was a formative experience. That was my first published thing.
Did you become friends with them afterwards, or no? Did that never happen?
Many years later. Yeah. So after when I graduated from high school, it was like graduation night, and it was late night, and me and some friends were having some illegal beers in my parents' garage. Yeah. They didn't know, but we were up to no good.
Did they really not know, or were they just like rolling their eyes in the kitchen? Like, whatever.
No, they really didn't know. But like me and the kid who I had clawed hadn't really had a whole lot of engagement like over the past, you know,
old Scarface.
Ten years.
Like lined out of it.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. I had not redeemed myself. And he came over and offered to smoke a blunt. And I was like, oh, this is it. Like, this is the true peace offering. And
so
we smoked that blunt together and like talked about what was going to happen next for us.
Wow.
Yeah. Buried that hatchet.
Usually I ask people at the top of the show to introduce themselves and tell the world who they are, but that's who you are. You're the claw hand kid. That's your story.
I'm the sociopath that your parents don't want you to play with.
No, you're Sean Kittleston. And I think most notably, because it's in your Twitter bio, you wrote Mortal Kombat 11. Injustice 2, and then you have a new comic book out, Heartbreaker, right over here.
Oh, Heart Attack. There you go.
Hold on, there it is. Heart Attack. It broke. It slid off. Oh, you got the paper one. I got the Comixology. I bought the Comixology version.
Well, that's what you got to do.
Yeah.
I'm 99-1 digital to print now. So.
Yeah, 100%. Because it's just like I look at your shelves, and that's beautiful. But I, of course, live in San Francisco. I got no room for all that. You know what I mean?
Like,
I can't be putting trade paperbacks everywhere.
Dude, I mean, even living in LA, we don't have a basement. So that is the it's such a difference. My parents have like a whole house beneath their house that I recall growing up with that, and that's not my life. I live with that stuff in my house.
That it's like, you know, I have a lot of obviously like, you know, concerns, especially in corona times or whatever, about my parents. But when I do think about inevitably, sadly, one day when my dad passes, right, all the comic books and long boxes and toys and you know, mint on card Superman figures that are in his attic, and it's like, what am I gonna do with any of this?
Oh,
what am I gonna do?
I've got so many like whole pieces of furniture, and then yeah, long boxes, action figures, all of that. It's, I'll tell you what though, for my son coming to visit Noni and Pop Pops, getting to play with all of dad's old toys, like,
yeah,
it's that's a treat.
That's the one treat. Thing that's the, you know, what I hold out hope for is that, you know, if Jen and I have kids one day, going home, getting those, and just like, I don't know, I don't want to just, because, you know, I know I have the giant Ninja Turtles bag that's packed with all my DC figures, all my Marvel figures, all my Ninja Turtles, and like, how would I give that to a child? I don't want to just drop them all on them, you know what I mean? Repackage them, gift them, be cheap, you know what I mean? I don't want to give them new things all the time.
Well, and that's, you know, that's where you also run into some really interesting encounters with your 8-year-old toys. Like when your kid is like, what's this? And you're like, oh, that's the Terminator. But he's like, the Terminator. So I can watch that too. Cause you had this when you were a kid. So is that a kid thing? And you're like, no, that's an R-rated movie.
No, they made children's
toys for it. Like
it was a different time. We weren't doing that.
That's John Rambo. He's soaked in the blood of his enemies. But
this is the Predator. Don't worry about him. You'll learn about him when you're older. We just love to play with that. Yeah. So I like to talk about everything, obviously, and I already know from talking to you many a time that we can just go on for hours and hours and hours.
Yes.
I want to start here with the most pressing issue, and it would be, how does one get to the point of writing Mortal Kombat 11? You wrote a Mortal Kombat game. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is kind of ridiculous when I think about it. Like, I have Scorpion over my shoulder now. He's like the angel on my shoulder, always looking out for me. My dark guardian angel. I'll give you the super capsule.
Sure.
That will catch everyone up. I was a Mortal Kombat kid.
Yeah.
I think my first recollection of Mortal Kombat was at a Pizza Hut in the arcade area there. It was a game that I recall my parents did not want me to buy or own for my Super Nintendo. But there was no blood in the SNES version of MK1. And then MK2, I lied to my folks, told them there was a blood code. But there wasn't a blood code. Not in that version, not in the Super Nintendo version. And when they saw the blood on, I was already several hours in.
Oh, I'm sorry, guys. I don't know. That's what my GamePro said.
Look, I'm looking at it now. I don't feel any different. I think it would be okay. Years later, when I was paying my mortgage with it, that was vindicated. To get to there, I started working. My first job in the industry was at DC Comics.
An okay place to start.
Yeah, not bad. I was there at like a very fortunate time. Like the stars aligned for me in that sense, in that I came in, I was the last hire at DC New York before the whole company was restructured. And then I was actually one of the first people out to DC, California, when the Burbank offices opened.
Yeah, everything moved, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a really pivotal time for DC and a really formative time in my career.
So what do they hire you as? What do you get hired as?
I started as assistant editor for Interactive. I edited books as well as games. So I edited like the Smallville RPG books and the DC Adventures RPGs.
Hell yeah, you did. Give me some Smallville RPG book stories. That's what I want.
It's mostly how they tuned the mechanics so well to actually create Smallville episodes. Like the writer's room could have used this thing. It was like, all right, someone's been knocked out, like roll to find out if they saw Clark use his powers before they were knocked out or after. Like, how are we gonna deal with this? Very, very, very great. Or do they have a concussion? It was like, does the knockout send them to the hospital or are they okay after?
Everyone has a concussion in Smallville.
That's the takeaway, is that everyone in Smallville is like at this point in their lives dealing with many a traumatic brain injury.
100%.
But yeah, I started out, so I was editing those books, but I was also editing games. In a sense more of like that you would think of as a creative executive or creative development.
So what does that mean? Yeah, like, are you getting scripts and going through and editing?
Everything, any creative content, like art, scripts, game design documentation, all of that, DC had purview over, like review and approval. And I was the person who would review and approve along with the rest of the team there. And there was like me and my boss, John Morgan, Tori Sedian, who's now over at Avalanche. She's an executive producer there. She's awesome. But yeah, we were a small crew, and we would any game. So my first game that I got to review was Arkham Asylum. Charmed, like a very charmed, wonderful time. We were working on DC Universe Online for a number of years there. Like, that's still on. It's crazy that game is still alive. I wonder if my Easter egg is still there. You could rescue me in the Hive. Someone in the Hive had taken me hostage. I was a scientist.
Okay.
Star Lab scientists who have been taken hostage, and you could free me.
I guarantee, as somebody who plays DC Universe Online, and I was ridiculous about it at launch and for that first probably 2 years, and now I just dropped in not too long ago and I ran a bunch of old stuff. Your voice is still in there.
It's still crazy. Yeah, I see my name in the game. That was the first time I saw my name like in a game, and it really threw me. So then I got to work on a lot of DC games. Injustice 1 was the one that introduced me to NetherRealm Studios.
Sure.
And having been a lifelong fan, part of what I wanted to do was portray to Ed Boon that things would be better than they had been on MK versus DC, and there wouldn't be all these restrictions. But also, like, we still have to keep it authentic, but I'm not going to put too many restrictions and try to handcuff you creatively.
So wait, real quick, full stop. Yeah. Are you the guy for Injustice 1? Like, you're the DC guy that's, like, talking to Ed and doing all these things?
For Injustice 1, yeah, I ended up becoming the guy for a time. And then I left DC before the game came out. But NetherRealm, like, there's a policy, a really weird one, that if you leave, you lose your credit, even if you've, like, carried the game for a few years.
Yeah, there's a couple of studios I know that have that kind of thing where, yeah, if you're not there to cross the finish line, you're not in the credits.
Exactly. But NetherRealm were super cool and gave me acknowledgement and the special thanks, which, like, I didn't know they were going to do that. And I played the game. I beat the story mode and I watched the credits. And when I saw my own name came up, like, it choked me up because it was a little acknowledgement that, like, yeah, I'd put a lot of my life into that and my work, like trying to get approval for Superman to be a bad guy. And, you know,
was that a hard
that story? Yeah, very hard sell.
It's one of those now, like, I mean, Injustice, not only as a video game series franchise, like, is so revered as a fighting game thing, it's also celebrated so much for its story, let alone then you go to the comics and the stuff Tom Taylor was doing is so, you know, out of this world.
Again, it's like all of these projects that I got to work on at this early point in my career were things that were the stars were aligning on them, like the work that Tom did in the comics and the fact that, like, the story was produced. Like, I remember reading the first version of the Injustice 1 story mode script and saying, like, so how much is going to get cut out of this? Like, I think it's my first call with the team after I'd read the script, the full script for the first time, after we'd been through, like, they'd go through early pitches, we'd done outlines, we'd worked on, like, in-depth treatments, and they gave me a script and I read it. And then I said, how much is getting cut? And they're like, we're going to do all of it. God help us. We're going to do all of it. And it was like, and they got, I would say 90% of what was in that script into
what they cut, what they cut, what was too much.
There's probably some stuff with, Atlantis, when the Atlantis invasion happens, like, I think there was some action that had to get scaled back. But it's always the big city, like, wide destruction scenes are the ones that are the first to, like, all right, this is kind of far away from the fight we're going to have. So how much of this should we focus on? But yeah, that experience then led me to getting an opportunity. A couple of years later, I was no longer at DC Comics. I was working as a creative director in ad agency. And Tori Sedian, who had worked with me at DC at the time and was now a producer at WB Games on the NetherRealm games, like, called me up and was like, hey, you want to pitch for some Mortal Kombat comic books? And I was like, well, I haven't got any credits yet. Like, why would anybody want me? And she was like, NetherRealm thinks you know their stuff.
Oh,
and we're having trouble getting something that's, like, authentically MK. And so I wrote my pitch and got it in. And that was my first freelance writing gig in a long time.
Dude.
And around the same time I sold the pitch for Heart Attack, which is just coming out.
Yeah, I was gonna say, what year did you pitch Heart Attack?
2013.
2013. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll talk about Heart Attack in a little bit. It's volume one out right now. Actually, volume one's out digitally right now. You can get it.
It's out in bookstores tomorrow.
Yeah. And you hit some things right on the head there. And I want to know how that feels to get to the world after a global pandemic and an oppressive regime here. It's like, oh, geez,
little close to home.
Exactly.
But anyway. Anyway, I pitched. I got MKX Comics. That was an awesome gig, like, and it sort of, again, was my opportunity to show NetherRealm now, like, hey, I can consult, I can write, I can do this well. They liked the comics. The fans really had a great response to the comics, and that ended up a year later turning into a phone call to say, hey, how would you feel about coming and working with the writing team? And that led to me being the narrative lead and co-writer with Dominic Cianciolo. Which is pretty awesome, like, hell of a gig. I'm a Superman kid. So that was, like, a big major moment in my career to feel like, oh gosh, I'm writing my Superman movie. I'm doing it. And it's not just a Superman movie, it's a Justice League movie, man.
Yeah.
And then I remember seeing Batman v Superman and feeling kind of like, okay, we did something different with Batman v Superman. So I still feel like I have the best Justice League movie this year. Like, I'm confident. Yeah. Then I saw Justice League in theaters and I was like, I definitely have the best Justice League movie this year. I feel very good and confident about that. But no, that game led to Mortal Kombat 11 directly. Like, I was still working on Injustice 2. I was writing, we were finishing up dialogue and beginning DLC character dialogue for Injustice 2, and we started pitching for MK11. And right from the beginning, it was like Ed Boon saying, "Hey, I want to do something different. I want to do something that's never been seen." And we were like, "Okay, that's really hard."
Because we also, you're a fan, you know how incredibly difficult that was. I mean, let alone, you know, 10 games and comics and movies and cartoons, and I mean, you name it, it's been it. And like Mortal Kombat's this IP that's been everywhere,
without a doubt. And I learned how passionate the fans were for the lore through the comics. Because if there's anything that's going to bring out the fans who know the lore best, it's a comic book tie-in. It's the people who are going to seek that out and say, like, I love Sub-Zero enough, I'm going to go find this book and I'm going to read it. And that was, I think, instructive of both of my experiences on the NetherRealm games with MK11 and with Injustice 2. It's just like, I came at it so much as a fan, and I poured so much heart and soul into those games and the things that I was a fan of. And it felt like this great, I don't know, therapeutic, like 30 plus years of this stuff, just like pouring it all out. Like, I'd been ingesting it for so long to go from being a fan to someone on the inside getting to work on the games at a time when there's still people from the original MK team, like Ed and Steve Baran and John Vogel, people who were there on day one, that are making this homage to day one today. It was a wonderful time.
How did it ever get normal? When were you able to get over that? Of you show up at NetherRealm in Chicago, right? And you're talking to these people and you're like, cool. Like, is that something you talk about on day one of like, hey, when I was a kid, I was playing, and they're like, we are old as fuck. But I mean, no, are you ever able to get over talking to Ed Boon?
It was always cool. Like, I would get over it in the moment.
Yeah.
And then I'd kind of walk away and be like, that was cool. Like, that was a cool thing. Like, little kid Sean is inside all the time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, dude, did you just pitch that? That's what and that was, I think, though, one of the things that's been good for me in my career, and I guess good advice I'd give everyone, is like, if you're a fan, the best way to show it isn't to gush about being a fan. It's to come and do really great work with people. Like, and I know that sounds counterintuitive because you have to get the opportunity to work with the people first. And that's really hard to do. And I was really lucky to have the opportunities that I did at the age that I did.
And that's the other thing. You talk about it, you know, you're in New York, you go to work for DC Comics. Like, that's the first gig. Like, how old are you? And did you just come out of school and go right to that?
I was 24 years old. So I was just a couple of years out of school. I had sold a screenplay. I'd written a screenplay and sold that.
Did it turn into something? What was it?
No, unfortunately. Okay. I mean, the economy crashed in 2008. I graduated from college in 2007. And then a year later, I had all these opportunities and I felt like I had some heat, but I also didn't write fast enough. Like, another good lesson for aspiring writers. If you sell a screenplay and someone gives you like a buttload of money, and all you have to do is give them 100 pages, and then they'll potentially give you more money, write that 100 pages in 40 days or less.
How long did you take to write your 100 pages, Sean?
9 months.
God damn it, Sean. Come on.
The money was
for you to focus.
Yeah, it was such a noob move on my part. But it taught me a valuable lesson.
Like, put on your sunglasses, like Ferris Bueller, kicking up your feet. Like, I made an uneasy street. They said this would be a hard life. Man.
Yeah, no, I was definitely like, I was doing other gigs at the time and writing other things, but I also kind of I took so much pride in like a single page. And nowadays it'd be like, if you didn't hit 5 pages, you've wasted the day. And that's kind of, it was good that I did that back then and kind of cratered early, because it did force me to then go break in at a very entry level position at DC that I really only got because I had been the editorial assistant for a guy named Douglas Rushkoff, who is a brilliant media theorist who his book, Media Virus, in 1998 was fairly predictive of the world that we live in now. His new stuff with Team Human is really awesome. I urge everyone to check that out. But he called Paul Levitz when I was like on my last dollar to be like, hey, I got this kid. he's been doing reporting and editorial stuff for me, and he's smart. He's not going to let you down. And he really needs a job. Can you get him this interview? He wants it so bad. And Paul Levitz, bless his heart, the next day I got called in for an interview after like 5 years. Because the minute I moved to New York City, you best believe that I had my resume at Marvel and DC. Like
on day
like,
one, bam.
Day one, every opportunity for an internship, I was pushing for it and I never got it. And then I hit the jackpot after college, a year after college, I hit the jackpot, found this job at DC. Pretty amazing.
So when would you go to school for writing? Is that, or what'd you go to school for?
I went to NYU for dramatic writing. I started the film program, realized I just wanted to focus on writing and then switched to dramatic writing. After a gap year, I kind of went around the country and did my thing, being a really degenerate.
A lot more doobies and beers and garages, I assume.
Yeah. Like I got my acoustic guitar and I got my
surfboard. I'm just taking a year, man. I'm just figuring it out.
Yeah, I'm finding the country. I'm just finding me. But I think that's also a good experience. It forced me to mature.
Totally.
All that stuff does.
So then when you went to dramatic writing, were you assuming you were going to be writing for screens, or did you want comics, or were you open to anything, games? Like I always find it interesting because I feel like, as you know, I knew I wanted to write about games from the fourth grade, right? But that meant I knew, at least in some respect, whether it was going to be, I didn't expect video, but if it was going to be a magazine or online, I knew that part. But I'm always, you know, even when I talked to like Gary Whitta, who's, you know, he went and wrote Book of Eli. And then it was, I think, so easy for someone like me who doesn't understand the industry or that real side of the creative brain to be like, okay, cool, he's a screenwriter. And then to see Gary, no, I write comic books. No, I write novels. No, he's just a writer. Like, did you know that early on?
Yeah, I think I excelled. Like, language was kind of my gig. I was into art too, like in a big way. So I drew a lot, and now I have a son who draws all the time. And I think it's pretty amazing to see how he's expressing himself. There's a lot of Spider-Man.
I was going to say it's small on my screen, but in the background there is a Spider-Man on the wall, right?
I have enough Spider-Man and Venom and everything else to fill. I mean, this is
there it is.
There it is.
Oh man, he's good. How old?
6 years old.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
He does.
But now is that now? Are you letting yourself dream that much that he continues on the artist route, and one day you guys get to do your book where you write it and he draws it?
That would be the ultimate. I don't know. That would be the best project ever. In a lot of ways, like I used to think that my work would be my legacy, and now it's like, well, no, he's my legacy for sure. Yeah, like it's the work is just a perk. But yeah, he's amazing. I knew early on though that I could write. Like that was kind of like, because you get that feedback at school.
Sure.
It's so like, it's such like a dopamine hit when you find out you can write, and the grownups are impressed with your like vocabulary and your ability to complete your thoughts and speak eloquently. And I was sort of often like the representative for the class, right? To like,
sure,
all right, we want to ask. It's like sex ed in fifth grade, and they're like, ask how if you can pee in a woman.
Excuse me, sir, I have a question on behalf of my brethren.
When a man is erect, is it possible for him to urinate whilst erect?
You got like a bubble pipe, like listening.
Yeah, and we actually got a straight answer on that question.
Sure.
The answer is no. There's nature found a way to stop that from happening.
Of course. God. There's a little valve, right? That switches it off.
Yes, exactly.
Right. This was a Greg Miller question too, growing up, I'll have you know. I remember watching the video and it did. I was like, thank you very much for teaching me something today.
Thank you for teaching me. Every little boy needs to know how things like, what, tell me how this cross-references. I've got pee, I've got poop. Now I have matic semen.
Yeah.
How can I cross-reference all of these? Because that's how the boy mind works.
Exactly. I just got to know what's happening, what's going where.
Yeah. Did you ever publish books in school, like in elementary school? They'd have like a little book publishing unit and you'd bind it and illustrate it yourself and all that.
Totally.
I found an About the Author from when I was like seven that said like, Sean is going to go to DigiPen and then go work for Nintendo making video games.
Nice.
And I never made it to Nintendo, but I did have a number one selling game on the Switch. So I think that counts.
I'll allow it.
There you go. And I do think that in some ways, like I didn't go to DigiPen, I had a much more circuitous course, and there was a point where I was like, wait a minute, did I try to go for other things and I never thought I'd be in games? But then I found that about the author bio from so many years ago, and I was like, no, I've just always loved games. There just came a point where it seemed a little bit less accessible to me because I wasn't interested in coding. I learned to code in high school.
Yeah.
And then I kind of gave up on it because I wanted, screenwriting was easier and sexier. It seemed like more money. But the more I got back into games, once I started working at DC, and like the more that I worked with the really talented developers I was working with, the more I felt like, wait a minute, there can be a lot of creative satisfaction in this medium, and I'm getting to see people at like the peak of their craft, and I'm getting to hang with them and throw my opinions in and my analysis and critiques of their work. And that's making me feel like maybe I've been thinking about this all wrong. Like, why should I just enjoy the games and give notes on the games? Like, why wouldn't I want to make them? And that definitely became a good ambition to drive me the last few years.
So talk about, making a game and writing a game. Like, I know, Insomniac, just what, last year, Time's a Flat Circle, maybe the beginning of this year. When I was going to the office, I bought their script book that actually came with like the script of it. And I thought, what a genius idea that you don't see game developers by and large do. And I think that writing a game, especially when you're talking about something like any game with multiple choices and multiple branches, even Mortal Kombat having different win-lose scenarios, it gets so difficult for me to sit there and rationalize how you write that and how much you describe, when obviously you're turning it over to hundreds of people to animate, environment, this thing and the other. How do you go about writing a video game?
It's a massive planning project. Like there's I think a project management layer that complicates it more so than and when you're writing a screenplay, you're kind of writing from the heart in a lot of ways, unless you have a very specific like production scenario in mind. But if you're just writing Blue Sky or going page one, you can write anything. In a game, it's very different. There's a lot more, there are a lot more dependencies in game design and in game development that mean that you have to really think about what you're putting on the page. You have to think about how a cinematic is going to interact with the interactive portions, right? How are those going to play off each other? And then you also have to think that the person playing is not watching a movie. That's like the first like spell that you have to break for yourself. Is like, it's really about the player's experience. And so you're not there to just give them endless story. You're not there to give them your best dialogue. You're there to motivate them to play the game. And if you follow that guiding principle of like, well, what is the player's motivation? And then what does the narrative need to do to support that motivation? That's to me like the fundamental, this is where we start with our design. And, you know, for Injustice 2, you could say that the fundamental, like, why are players motivated to fight each other in this story mode? And you know that Batman and Superman already have this sense of antagonism. And in some ways that there's already Team Batman and Team Superman. So you have your two factions and they can go to war. But they already did that last time. And last time we had the multiverse involved. And like this time, what if we just focus on one universe, but we want to have some other outside actor? And that's where Brainiac came in as an idea.
Sure.
And tying Brainiac to Superman in a really important way that we borrowed from the animated series, where Brainiac is responsible for the destruction of Krypton and all of that, like, gave us this opportunity to say, like, wait, everyone can be involved in the circle. Everyone in this drama has a stake in what's unfolding. Like, Brainiac wants Earth. Superman wants revenge against Brainiac for what he did, but he also wants to protect Earth. Batman wants to protect Earth, so him and Superman overlap in their Venn diagram, but Batman also is worried about Superman's brand of justice.
Sure.
So now we have everyone in conflict, but also Batman and Superman in alignment. And that was always the goal, to be like, this is going to be Stalin and FDR getting together. They're going to whoop Hitler, and then they're going to turn and look at each other and go like, oh man, now I gotta deal with you. my old friend, my old enemy. And that was like, that setup wasn't just like a dramatic movie setup, right? That was a setup for how can we get the maximum number of fights into a fight ladder that for a game like Mortal Kombat is like 50 fights long, but you don't have 50 characters. So you got to fight some characters twice. who's going to be a jobber? Who's gonna get to dominate? Who are you going to build up? Who's going to be a boss? All of those questions are what dominate, like, the when Dominic and I were working on story modes, that was what we talked about more than anything. It was like months and months of just,
yeah, I have to imagine the whiteboard of fight numbers, putting them there, arguing about what would happen, and then the motivations to get them there.
There was a whole spreadsheet that fed out all kinds of data and metrics, so we could see, like, you know, fights per character. Were they fights where you played as the character or against the character? Like, a whole range of things to look at to just assess numerically, like, how are we distributing things? You do have to make choices. It's painful. I think there are many fans out there who think I hate their favorite character. Kotal Kahn, poor Kotal Kahn, he dies. And yeah, he's been
never
he's
got
been
his just reward
a bit. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, like, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. There are priorities. Most of the answers to fan questions, by the way, when fans are like, why wasn't such and such at here at this place in this moment? And you're like, there just wasn't budget to animate them. So they are there, but they are off screen.
Do you know how hard it is to make a character model? That's why. That's what we could do. Yeah. Did not have that bandwidth. We wanted to make the game look good on every character you love, not just that one.
Those games are a miracle. I mean, just like Injustice 1, the NetherRealm shoots so big. I think we scoped pretty well that by the time we were writing MK11, I knew well enough what not to do. And we didn't have really any major cuts that I can recall.
Yeah.
But there were two things cut from Injustice 2. That I think would have been awesome. And I still wish they were there. When Brainiac invades Metropolis, Swamp Thing was supposed to summon all the power of the green to create a giant Godzilla form and wrestle with the Brainiac ship, which was then going to blast a hole in him and take a sample of him. That would then become the enemy you would fight aboard his ship later.
Nice.
So I wish we had that moment, because the Godzilla Swamp Thing is, like, still on my bucket list.
Yeah.
And Harley Quinn was going to be in the Batcave during an attack by Brainiac bots. And there was, like, plans for this. It never actually happened. But the dinosaur that you see when, like, Kronika flashes back in time in MK11.
Yeah.
That dinosaur was originally built and considered for another stage for Injustice 2. Then it was almost in the Batcave as the robot dinosaur.
Nice.
And we were going to have Harley riding the robot dinosaur, taking out all the Brainiac bots, and let the player control it. And we had this plan for this whole side-scroller sequence. And it was a thing that, like, the producers were like, we're going to take a run at this and see if we can do it. It turned out to be, like, so hopelessly expensive. But that was a moment. That was one moment where I was like, I'm dreaming too big.
You got to take those swings, though, right? You got to.
You got to. How
many times are you going to get to hold that bat? I feel like that's, you know, for a DC fan, as long as you've been, let alone working there and doing all these things, to have that, you know, flight stick in your hands, you got to make sure you're going to go as hard as you can.
Yeah, I left it all out there. So I always feel good about that, where I'm like, man, because there's so much dialogue to write besides the story mode and gear and multiverse quests and stuff like that, that, it's like, yeah, I left all of my DC in that game. Yeah. And it's almost even hard. Like, it would be hard to think about working on more. And that's why, one of the reasons why I definitely admire what Tom's done on the comics, because of what he's done with both Injustice 1, years 1 through 4, plus Injustice 2, and whatever's coming up. I don't know what's coming up, but whatever he's teasing on Twitter, I'm excited for it.
Yeah, Tom's JSA great. Stuff it looked like. I don't know. I glanced at it. I'm like, he's doing the letters one by one on Instagram. I'm like, I'll wait. You tell me the whole thing, Tom. I'm in no matter what, but just I'm not going
to
sit here.
I don't need to be sold. I don't need to be sold on that. But that's the thing. Like, I look at what he's done and I think, like, man, it's a lot. Because even just doing, like, you know, 360 pages of MKX comics plus, you know, it's 180 pages of story mode. For MK11, well, plus Aftermath. So Aftermath was another.
Yeah.
So it's like over 200 pages, over 300 pages of Mortal Kombat script plus 300. Yeah, it's a lot. When you think about it, you're like, oh my gosh, I wrote thousands of pages of Mortal Kombat in my lifetime. Where did I find the time to do that?
Well, that's a question I had for you, actually, is, like, you know, when we're talking about Tom Taylor, obviously storied comic book writer, everybody should pick up his stuff. All New Wolverine's great. He's doing great stuff, obviously, with Injustice and so on and so forth. But when DC's, I look at And when I look, exactly, yeah, Deceased, again, another one where he like finishes it and then right under the other one, right under the other one, right under the other. But when I look at Tom Taylor and I look at somebody like, you know, Bendis, and you see these people who have like so many ongoing books, so many things all the time, do you fall into what I assume their camp is, where you're just writing nonstop? Like, I know you're a bit different because we're talking about big budget video games in this. Obviously, like I already said, Heart Attack, volume one out right now. Go get it. We'll talk about that in a second. But are you like, okay, I'm going to do a screenplay today, I'm doing the comic tomorrow. Are you, know, in free time, are you jotting down notes? Like, your son's on the swing and then you whip out your note apps and you're like, hold on, this is a good idea.
I wish I was like that. I have to like get very like into it to write. So I need to dedicate like a whole day to the task, because it's, to me, it's very hard to switch it on and fit it into my hours here and there. And that's what made Heart Attack like took a long time to write. I wrote the first six issues over the first few years and then took my time because I was busy writing the games. And I sort of made a decision. One of the reasons I started freelancing and I left being a creative director at an ad agency was that I wanted my time back because I had my son, and it changed my life like in so many ways. And I think I'm one of those people that I need to be so involved with my work and it's so deep into the logic and rationale of that world and feeling it, feeling like the rhythms and the smells, smelling the smells of that world, all of that, that like I need to go into a place where I can't usually access for just 1 or 2 hours a day. Like, I like to be there for 4 or 5 or 6 hours. I like to get it in. I don't sit down. I stand while I write, which helps with all of that. So I can do these like long day burns writing. I fit it in that way. I plan it out. I plan like writing time. It's almost like a ritual. Like, I'm going to go to the Church of Writing and I'm going to worship at the keys today. In the key of Mortal Kombat 11. Like, that's how I have to do it. Other people can do it all kinds of ways. I know Tom like writes by night. Tom Taylor writes by night. I can't do that. I can't be nocturnal. I don't know how he does it.
He's got kids.
I think he's a little, he's probably about my age. Like, I mean, come on. That's how does your body take it? I'm trying. So I've come around to trying to live my best life and fit in my writing where I can. And fortunately, like I've gotten to work on some things that are very satisfying, but I sort of shifted a lot over the last year with the work that I'm doing for Skybound now, where I'm the creative director for Skybound Games.
Congratulations.
Cheers. Where instead of just working on one game, I'm working on a whole slate of, we've got Walking Dead. In some ways, there's some components of the work I used to do at DC that are similar.
Yeah.
Although there is like a bit more, I have a lot more control over the approach, and there's definitely a different relationship with the work, because you've got Robert there and you've got the creators. Yeah. So you've got the creators. And for that goes for any Skybound thing, not just the Walking Dead stuff. Like, we're a very creator driven company. So,
but yeah, hold on, full stop. I know, because I'm a huge nerd, but there's a lot of people who don't know. Yeah. What is Skybound?
So Skybound is a transmedia entertainment company that currently publishes The Walking Dead. The Walking Dead is over. Pour one out. Unless you picked up Negan Lives.
You know, I did.
In July. But not only The Walking Dead, but a range of comics, including my book, Heart Attack, which is not a vanity project because I sold it to them before I started working with them.
And they were like, this is so good. Hire this guy.
Yeah, I do think that had to have some bearing on it. But the Skybound is involved in games, TV, film, podcasts, and audio, tabletop gaming. If you've ever checked out some of the Cyanide and Happiness tabletop stuff and their Kickstarters, like, you've definitely seen some Skybound work there. Trial by Trolley, games like Super Fight.
I was going to say, if you're an old school kind of funny fan, Super Fight, we did a promotional video on how to play that, like 20
years,
like whatever.
So Skybound's like spread out in a lot of different areas. And one of the things that changed the business for them was the Telltale's final season, and going through and rescuing that final project and bringing the team back to finish it and bringing that out to market, because it was a hell or high water move on Skybound's part. I wasn't there at the time, but for them, it was, this is the thing we have to do, because this is, we are the fans first and creators first company.
Yeah.
And how are we serving the fans if we let this thing die?
And that's one of the things, I think, you know, you've mentioned it, but I want to point out, I think, as somebody who just is a comic book fan, right? Doesn't really, well, I guess you have games, so I guess I'm kind of a critic of that part of your job, but like, it is that idea that I think where Skybound is so cool is the fact that it's all creator owned. Like when you, when you partner with Skybound, you're not signing over the rights to your project. It's still your project. They're just helping it get to market. They're using their now vast team. I remember when Skybound was so small, their vast team for merchandise and promotion and all these things, right? You're coming in to help creators get their work to a larger audience, but still retain all the rights and be able to make money off of it.
Yeah. And one of the unexpected benefits of the Telltale like situation was that it pushed Skybound to create a games publishing unit.
Yeah.
And so that's where I spend a lot of my time these days, is reviewing games and finding projects and original games to publish. And I think we've got a really exciting slate coming up of things that are not Walking Dead related at all, and not even comic book related, but are just like cool things from creators that we believe in and voices that we think deserve like more of a platform, and that Skybound is trying to give them. And then, yeah, we've got more Walking Dead. So
the hardcover of Alien, is that out yet? I forget the game.
Out in the same release schedule as Heart Attack Volume 1. So out in comic shops now and out in bookstores tomorrow.
Yeah. So let's dial it back. 2013.
Yeah.
Heart Attack.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That's when you got the idea of writing it, or is that when you sold it? Like, how does 2013 enter the picture? And then how is it 7 years later that it's finally out?
I know. In 2013, I was thinking about freelancing more. I was working as a creative director in an ad agency, and I wasn't happy like being that guy. I wanted to be making things there's nothing wrong with advertising, by the way. I love games marketing, and I understand it better than I ever would have if I hadn't worked in it for a few years. And I think the thing that I learned is that there are good people out there who want to market your game based on the values of your game.
Sure.
And those are the people to look for. But I was just not happy, because I wanted to be closer to the metal, so to speak. I wanted to be like really, really working in the nuts and bolts of a game. And that was one of the reasons why I left to freelance. And I had this idea as I was on my way out. I remember I was on a flight. I was flying all the time for this creative director work. It was very Don Draper, but in a t-shirt. Like nerd Draper. I would call myself like MC Sean Draper, creative Dereka. That was my rap name. But
I don't think that career is going to take off. Stick with
that passed. That was like my Dave moment. No, I never recorded anything under a rap moniker. I would be terrible. I'd be terrible. But I was flying. I remember being on this flight from Europe, and someone had the Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet playing on their laptop. And I ended up like watching the whole movie like on their laptop, just kind of out of the corner of my eye while I was working on something else.
The classic plane move, right? Where you won't turn on your screen to watch what it, but one row up and one seat over someone's, you're just like, yeah, I do it all the time. Play a game and watch what's happening.
This wasn't available on the plane. This was like their personal, they had it downloaded on their laptop. And so the only way to watch this, long story short, I was like, I really want to write my Romeo and Juliet story. Like, I love romance. I've gone so far from like my Say Anything roots. That was like the screenplay I remember studying more than anything in high school. Was like, I want to be Cameron Crowe. And instead, I ended up working in like superhero blockbusters.
I've never seen that over and over again.
So get, I was like, I've got this romance itch, and I know that Skybound is looking for things. So I want to pitch, like, I was going to pitch a couple of things. Sean Makowitz and I came up together at DC. He was an assistant editor. Now he's the SVP and editor in chief for Skybound's comics publishing. And on the way there, he was editing The Walking Dead and trying to kickstart this Skybound comics line. And he said, hey, if you have any pitches, because we were just talking, just catching up. And I was like, yeah, I think I might start pitching stuff. And he's like, well, if you have pitches, pitch me. So I always take that opportunity if someone offers. And this was like the one that he clued in on. I had like the title Heart Attack, and I wanted it to be like in a divided city where like there's the resistance and there's this other person on the other side of that resistance, and they were going to fall in love, and it was going to be this whole star-crossed lovers thing. And that was like the initial like pitch that that sold it. But then I started developing it more, and I was at South by Southwest a few months later. So this is like early 2013, I think. And I'm at South by, and I just started getting this feeling of like, I feel like there's something in Austin. There's like a weirdness in Austin, the gentrification, the way, like I would ask about like, what street are we on? What's this neighborhood all about? This and that. And my friends in Austin would share the history with me. And I'd be like, oh, there's a lot of, the narrative in Austin is a lot more than just like Austin is weird. And Austin is the blue island and the red place. Like, it's more like Austin is ground zero for a lot of tension and a lot of like historic racial pain. And I just thought like, all right, well, I know how this, and once I read up on the history, cause this is the nerd that I am when I'm at a place and I'm like taking in the culture and the sights and sounds, I immediately start going like, I wonder what the history of this place is. And the more that I learned about the history of Austin and how segregated it was, in such a way that there was actually a district created and all of the black residents were pushed into that city by all means of Jim Crow coercion to create, you know, East Austin. That to me, I was like, all right, there's the historic foundation for a lot of pain and suffering and people fighting over that line. And then I thought, what would that look like in the future? That then turned out to look a lot like today.
We're living the prequel to Heart Attack right now is what's happening.
Yeah, we really are. And it's to give everyone like the bottle pitch or the elevator pitch on it. So if you're not familiar with the book, because it's not Mortal Kombat 11. It doesn't have the marketing budget. So you may not have heard as much. But Heart Attack is about Charlie and Jill, who are two teenage activists, Charlie, a reluctant activist, Jill, a very committed influencer in the activist movement, who are fighting for variant rights because they are the children of people like us who were going through a pandemic and used genetic therapy and gene editing treatments to overcome the pandemic and overcome disease in general. However, in doing so, the children that they gave birth to had different genetic traits that rendered them somewhat non-human, and the United States has not given them human rights. And so there are some places like Austin where an oppressive police force has been tasked with essentially kidnapping these variants off the streets. And our heroes in the book are two people who are trying to fight against them while simultaneously, little bit of a spoiler alert, but Charlie is a mole for the police, and that complicates everything that he and Jill do. So how can this guy who's supposed to be on the inside and falling for a girl who's in the resistance work with this woman who is like the epitome of the resistance, and they are connected by this strange cosmic fact that whenever their hands touch, they get superpowers. And this is a world where variants, although they have different DNA, they don't really have crazy powers. They're like a little bit faster, a little bit stronger, a little bit smarter, but they're not X-Men level mutants. But Charlie and Jill, whenever their hands touch or whenever their skin touches, they get telekinesis and pyrokinesis. And that changes the whole dynamic of the fight for freedom in Austin. But if you have those powers, and you're in this city that's so historically divided, does just like throwing a fireball or like lifting a car with your mind suddenly undo 100 years or more of prejudice and division and pain and hate? Like, no. So that's what the book is about. The book is about, once you have the power to make change and you try to make that change, how are you actually going to do it? How are you going to be responsible for the things that you affect?
Yeah. And, you know, I've read volume one. I loved it. I thought it was great. And it is that thing of watching it escalate where I think you started off the book and I was like, okay, you know, book issue one, like, okay, like I see what's happening. I see where we're going. All right, blah, blah. And then to get to where we end volume one, right, with them looking at each other and having that realization of like what their choices have led to in terms of other people's lives, in terms of the city of Austin, in terms of all this other stuff. I think that's the most fascinating part of the journey. And again, for something you started in 2013 to sit here and have the parallels to the world we're living in, right? Where, yeah, it is that, you know, even issue one, they talk about, you know, the old pandemic and how this is how it happened, how variants happened, is that we found a cure for that, but this was the outcome of it. I think you'd think it would be, I think reading it, you could easily think this was way more contemporary, at least created more contemporarily than it was, when in reality it wasn't. And hats off to you, and granted, this is what I always talk about when we talk about things like this, of, again, my white privilege or whatever, right? Of, I go to Austin all the time for video game events and, see Rooster Teeth people and be a moron and take off my shirt and chug a beer and go home and eat barbecue, right? And go to Rainy Street.
I shave my beard off and wear a mustache when I'm in Austin.
Yeah, right? You got to. But then I knew nothing about East Austin like you're talking about. And the wall is so important. I-35 in your book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how I was like, okay, cool. I was thinking when they said, go to the wall, I wish they built the wall more. I was originally thinking like, oh, are they talking about like the wall to Mexico? Is it that kind of thing? And then to get here and be, no, it's this wall separating, where we want the variance versus where we are, this protection for us, low income area nobody cares about. But then to have you explain in just one page, right? Five panels tops of just here's how what they did to the Black community back then. Here's what they did when the actual outbreak started, which we're living right now. And here's how that, the governor, or who would become the governor, played it to her advantage to have it actually be that, no, we're going to talk about powers of mass destruction. We're going to fear monger. We're going to do all these different things to actually drive home our point and turn people against each other. And I think, to get there and have the story told from the people with, or the variants, their abilities, and how, I can barely warm my hands. I can't really do anything, but we're being made out to be this horrible thing. And then to find these two that have those abilities together, what do they do with them? Right. And I think there's a really powerful conversation there where it is, if we're us and we're the first people with these powers. So if we do something good with these powers, if we show people we're not to be feared, maybe that starts turning the tide. But if we don't, and other people do it first, are they on the same page as we are right now? And it's like, oh, wow. Like, the deeper you get into it, I think obviously the deeper the story gets, but then the sides everybody's playing starts making more sense, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, the initial pitch was pretty close to what this is, except it was going to start, the first issue was going to start with a shooting, a police killing, instead of a police kidnapping. Yeah. And, this is a pre-Ferguson, script. The note was kind of from the editors was like, listen, we don't think that if someone got shot and this was placed online like this, that there wouldn't be like a mass demonstration the next day. Like, it would escalate so quickly. So maybe they need to not get killed. And I was like, oh man, I think that's where we're going though. I think people are going to start getting killed. They're like, well, that's very dark, but it also, you're not leaving a ramp for yourself to get anywhere. That was a really good insight, I think, because then I took it a lot further and decided like, well, what if they can't kill people because they've actually lost lethal ammunition? And that then started to give me this thinking of like, okay, so what if there was this time of peace and harmony post-pandemic where a lot of really progressive legislation went through and cops lost lethal force as an option? And now this was about a time when that force was being clawed back, because if you shift like one generation, it's just long enough for the previous generation to forget everything that the last generation knew. Or the new generation to forget everything the previous generation knew. And that's, that's how you get from World War I to World War II. Like, look at when they stopped. It's like, oh, just for enough time for a crop of young men to grow up and have no idea how bad this shit can get. And that was one of the catalysts for change that I felt like could now drive the book as a different kind of engine. And we could have a deeper discussion about what it means to use lethal force, what it means for police to oppress people or suppress people violently. It's not funny. It's more synchronous. I checked out your conversation with Gene Yuen Lang from a few weeks back, and I could sympathize so well, by the way, one of the the 99-1. This book. This book is as Superman gets, this is as good as Superman's been.
Superman in years. Smashes the plan if you missed
absolutely
it.
Absolutely fantastic. Essential. Yeah. That's why I own it in print, because it's worthy of being on the shelf. But like, I could relate to what he was saying about like, well, yeah, when I started writing this book, Heart Attack, I thought of it as a warning sign for how bad things could get. And then I do remember when Ferguson happened, getting a call from the editor saying, listen, there haven't been nationwide protests. It's been pretty limited. We're kind of surprised by how low-key the response has been to this shooting. Why don't we change it back? And I said, well, I think I'm already committed on, I think there's a cycle here to explore historically. Like, I don't need to change it back just because of what happened in Ferguson right now. But from Ferguson to here, you know, from 2014 to 2020 in particular, the country's been through so many changes.
Yeah.
And it's both, in some ways, it makes sense to me. It's a narrative that I can follow and that I can see how we got here. In other ways, it's very disheartening and disturbing to me because I wrote this book as a projection of my worst nightmare. I wrote this book as a projection of how bad things could get. And I was looking to places like Brazil, and I was looking to places like Hungary and Poland and Turkey and places where authoritarian regimes clamp down, China, all of these places that we love the people. It's not about the people, but we haven't, as Americans, I think, been aware enough of how much freedom has been eroded around the world, and democracy and the value of democracy has been eroding around the world. And to see what's happening now in the country and the sort of like disillusionment that so many of us feel, that like, oh man, if November doesn't go our way, what hope do we have left? Like, what, how, where can we go? Where can we take our pain? Where can we take our outrage? Who could have predicted this? Like, I, in some ways, Gene did. And in some ways, Heart Attack did. And in some ways, I think we were all feeling like this, like, current in the zeitgeist that was like demonstrating that despite everything that we felt we had achieved with President Obama and the election of the first Black president, and the idea that we could be a post-racial society, to just find out how far back we were, like, that is the white privilege right there.
Yeah.
But, you know, in many ways, trying to check my white privilege and to make sure that I'm being really sensitive to the issues at hand, I spent a lot of time. My advice to, you know, writers of any background is, don't just write about your own background, and don't just be capable of writing about your own background. You have to, even if it feels like you shouldn't write about, excuse me, about other people's experiences, that's literally the job. I've never been Superman. I've never been Liu Kang. I've never been Shao Kahn. But the job is, you write about other people's experiences. And if you immerse yourself in humanity and in experience, and you go to South by Southwest and you have a sense of awareness, you can develop things that matter. And you can do work that you believe in that is more in step with the times. Then maybe what else you would do if you weren't thinking broadly enough about other people's experiences are not the same as your own, and so you must do a lot of work and research to get to know who people are, all people, different kinds of people, and take those big swings at those stories. I mean, I did the Jax ending for MK11.
Yeah,
that got a lot of hate. Jax ends slavery. use the power of the hourglass to create a timeline in which slavery didn't happen, where the slave trade is just never a thing. And there were like people online going like, this is white genocide. Like, what?
No, this is a bad thing that we stopped here. What do you think?
I don't know if you realize it. I'm white, so I'm not trying to genocide me. I think we can all acknowledge that this was a bad thing that happened in history. The world would probably be better if we didn't have that. And yeah, maybe some of us wouldn't have been born, but guess what? We're not trying to undo the timeline. That's out of our power. It's recognition of the evils and the biases that we have inherited from our ancestors, our racist fuckwit ancestors. Sorry, I don't know if I can swear on here.
Oh yeah, fuck it up. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I've been so reserved.
Oh, no, don't worry about it. My apologies. Don't worry about it. You're crushing.
Chick, piss, cock, cunt. No.
There it is.
My mom's going to be watching. Just like, oh, Sean.
Right into it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Until then, you were so close to doing something.
I raised
right,
a good
Sean.
Boy.
I thought I raised a good... No, she knows. She knows.
You talk about the research and everything else, and obviously the Jax ending and stuff like that. Talk to me about that in this book, because I noticed, and I'm going to... Gary, the pastor/podcaster, right, who pops up at the end there, right? Like, he obviously has a different tact in terms of what he thinks protests should be. You know, where's your inspiration from that? Where did you, what kind of research did you do for that? Because there is that thing of like, you know, reading through it, even you write his dialogue with the accent that you envision him using, right? Are you looking at somebody like, you know, and in particular of any of the other televised preachers we would know from the South?
No, it's a combination of like televised preachers and a little bit of Killer Mike from Run the Jewels.
Gotcha.
But more so, I did watch a lot of preachers and think about the ways that they spoke to their people and the ways that they thought. And then, you know, there's a legacy that Gospel Gary represents of people who aren't afraid to go out and be nonviolent and understand that they're going to take a beating. And Sefton Smith, who was leader of the Free Bodies like activist movement and kind of more of a .com post-.com era activist leader, like he represents what I think a lot of us feel like sometimes, which is the more passive activist who does more of the activism from behind the keyboard and a microphone. And Gospel Gary represents that tradition that says, no, we actually have to go out in the streets, we have to let them beat us and prove that their cause is not, prove that our cause is good. But then there are, of course, agitators within the movement that are there to fight and are looking for a fight, and they ruin it for everyone else and justify, they give the police the opportunity to justify the horrible things that they do. And this is, you know, a real thing. And I felt like it would be really disingenuous to have the only voice for like leadership and authority in the activist movement be represented by someone like Sefton. I felt like it had to actually be about, no, there's deeper roots that go from John Lewis to Gospel Gary for what a movement is supposed to be. And I think if there's anything that I'm proud of that I wrote in that volume, it's Gospel Gary's speech to everyone that's there for the protest.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's powerful.
It's the thing where he's like, they're afraid of us because they're afraid of how extraordinary we can be. Like and that's how I feel about racism in America in so many ways, is there's a fear of what happens when a group that's been disenfranchised and disempowered is suddenly given that empowerment.
Sure.
That is, to me, that is the crux of the whole problem, is this fear that like, but what if we give them too much? What if we give them too much power? What if we give them too much welfare? What if we give Black people too many opportunities? And it's like, you cannot give people too many opportunities. You cannot give a person too much prosperity. You can only give someone too little. You can impoverish a people by denying them the opportunities that the rest of us enjoy. So, and that's, you know, I'm obviously very animated and passionate about this, and it's all a serious issue, but I'm not just trying to profit off it either. It's very important to me that I've had a great career in games, and I'm very lucky to do the work that I do. And so I am donating all of my print royalties for this book to the Southern Poverty Law Center. Because that's an organization that's actually fighting the good fight. That's one of many organizations, whether you donate to Black Lives Matter, whether you donate to Van Jones's organization, whether you donate to Southern Poverty Law Center or the ACLU, there's so many people who are out there fighting the fight that you can support. And I wanted this book in some way, shape, or form to support that. So no matter what, I'm committed to donating some money to them. And that's what I want my legacy in this book to be about. It's like, I believe that you don't have to be afraid to be an ally and an advocate. You have to put the diligence into your message. And then if you are a person in a position of privilege, you have to put that privilege into meaningful action. And if this is me, like if this is a lifetime of white privilege has gotten me the opportunity to have this book in any way, shape or form, why wouldn't I give back? Like if that is an opportunity that I can afford, like I'm not rich. I don't get royalties for Mortal Kombat 11. People are like, you must have made so much money on Mortal Kombat 11. Because I think it generated $500 million. And you're like, well, actually,
I signed on for a one-time payment.
I signed on for a contract that was doled out to me by milestone. And once I wrapped my contract, that was it. I get nothing after the fact. So like, again, I'm just a regular middle-class dad doing his middle-class dad thing. And you don't have to be rich to make a difference or to like to commit some of your money and resources. All you have to do is take a little bit of the opportunity and privilege that you've enjoyed and turn it into action for people who haven't had it. So, and in some ways that's, you know, my hope for my career, even working with Skybound and stuff like that, is it finding voices to highlight, finding other people who haven't had the opportunities that I've had, but also finding those outside views and bringing them in and giving them the platform.
You know, everything you just said, spot on, obviously. And I've obviously had conversations with you before, and I know a little bit about you. How much of everything you just said and your worldview and your wanting to help people, just help people in general, do you feel is influenced by your obsession with Superman?
So much.
Right? Because you don't have the same way, but like you have such a different, I know, connection to it all.
Well, yeah, Superman. I mean, I'm adopted, and Superman was the way that my parents explained what being adopted meant to me. It was from my earliest age, I can recall like this connection to the Superman narrative that was more about how you define yourself and how you choose to let your history and your circumstances define you versus like what really defines a person. And the way that, you know, to distill it down to me was, you came from a place where you were loved enough that someone like made sure that you found your way to parents who love you. And that doesn't mean that those people out there don't exist, but it means that you have a family here, and these are your parents, and they're going to give you the values that are going to shape the kind of person that you're going to become. So, you know, Superman is not just Superman because he has powers. Superman is Superman because he had Ma and Pa Kent. And because they instilled in him a sense of structure and values that, you know, I think I won't bag on the Snyder films, because I think there's a lot of beautiful work in them. But, you know, one area where they disappointed me was in the sense of like Ma and Pa Kent need to represent the best of American ideals, and they're sort of nihilistic Andean, like help them or don't, it's you have no commitments or responsibilities. That
should I have let them die, Pa? I don't know. I remember that being like such a radical thing for Jonathan Kent, who I've always thought is like this stalwart, like, you know, the one of the pillars of Clark and Superman. And granted, he is into this movie because that's what they wanted to go for, and I get that, and I want you to have all the artistic liberties. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That you want to take with it. But I was like, whoa, okay.
Yeah, that's, you know, to me, that's a complete like change in the way that Superman creates his identity. Like, do you believe that Superman's goodness is innate and something that was just passed on to him, you know, like through a sense of heroics that his parents represented? Or is his goodness something that his parents on Earth gave him and instilled in him? Because I'm raising a kid right now, and I can tell you, you make a lot of choices when you raise a kid, and you're making choices about which kind of kid you want to raise and what kind of parent you want to be. And I feel like the kind of advice that would have to be given to a kid with that kind of power would have to be the best advice. So to me, the best parents have to be Ma and Pa Kent, and they have to come in with that philosophy. And that's something, you know, I applied that to Injustice too. I applied that to the way that I thought about Clark Kent and like what had broken for him in so many ways. Like is once his parents are no longer there, and Tom did a really beautiful job like explaining what happened to the Kents, and I think, I don't know, I to me the Kents were the key. So Superman informed a lot of my career. Superman informed a lot of my personal drive now and things that I try to do with my work. But it also just helped me deal with the fact that I was adopted and I didn't know where I came from. And I needed to know that that I wasn't a monster. Like, I know that feeling. And we opened with it. But I always had this feeling that I was the weird kid or the outsider. And I never, you know, I'd look in the mirror and you don't know whose face is looking back at you. And, sure. And you grow up with that. You have a different relationship with your face when you don't have anyone to relate it to.
Sure.
So the fact that I've now been reunited, I was on Long Lost Family a couple of years ago, season 5, episode 2, on TLC. I was
publicly I've known you for years now, right? And I finally watched it yesterday. And like, well, you had told me, like, You're like, be prepared with Kleenex. And I kept it together. My wife, I sent you a photo of Jen sobbing. We were doing laundry. She's sobbing into a dish rag we just cleaned. And Portillo is on her staring at her like, are you okay?
Oh, man. And that's, you know, I always think of it as like, wow, what a soul-bearing moment to have so public that I never expected to be. Like, in all of the ways that I thought about that moment, did I ever think about it happening like on television? Absolutely not.
Do you regret it though?
No, not at all. They were really good. And, you know, the thing that isn't on the show is that, you know, I also met my birth father.
I didn't know that.
He didn't want to appear on the show because just for privacy concerns and
sure,
and wanted to, you know, meet me and develop a relationship without the cameras around. And so after production, he got in touch with me, and I have great relationships with both of them. I have siblings that I didn't know about, so I've met them. I've added a lot of people to my life.
Pretty quickly.
Very quickly. I've now reunited with over 200 biological relatives.
Wow.
Who I either have met in person, friended on Facebook, exchanged emails with, texts. It's crazy. I've learned something though. I always had this fear when I was younger that meeting all these people would change me. And I do think it was good that I waited until I was an adult, and I was like 30 years old when I really took up the search in earnest again. But more importantly, what I found is that you meet all of these new family members and you learn a lot about yourself, and you learn a lot about where certain echoes of the past come from, where certain elements of you come from. But I did find, if anyone's interested, that like it isn't nature versus nurture. Nurture is incredibly strong versus nature. And one of the most affirmative like moments of my life, or multiple affirmative moments, is just the sort of sense that I got from the family that I reunited with, when everyone has said to me, like, you know how lucky you were to have your parents, your mom and dad. Like, the circumstances that you could have been born into could have been a lot more difficult, and you never would have had these opportunities and done these things, but you got with your mom and dad, and they provided me with education, encouragement, the opportunity to go and pursue a career in the arts and pursue an education in the arts, and support all of that, and give me the mindset to work creatively and develop these ideas and not to be inhibited in so many ways that so many other people, I think, in their lives are just told that you can't do something. And I was told that I could do so many things. And so that's, if you wonder what it is that makes a person, it's the people around them. It's you are the product of the five people you spend the most time with. Right. Yeah. And that is what a human being is. A human being is you are, your blood is you, and there's a lot of your blood in you, and you'll find those echoes and your commonalities, and you'll find easy ways to jive with people that have the same blood as you. But the thing that can't ever be replicated is just the personal relationships, the emotional relationships that you develop with people shape you in amazing ways.
The one question I had watching the show, and then I think also knowing your story and knowing your connection to comics, did your parents ever have that moment when you wanted to set off and try to find your birth parents, like we've seen represented with Ma and Pa Kent before, where there is that like, go get them, but we're worried what if your relationship, you know, is stronger with them or something to that effect?
Oh yeah. I mean, there are a couple of times, anytime that I knew I was going to start looking, cause I started in my 20s, like doing DNA tests and stuff like that. And they always offered to like buy me the DNA test. And I was like, no, this is something I have to do this. I don't want to
my journey.
Yeah. You guys paid for NYU. I'm good. you let me graduate debt free, and it made your own retirement less comfortable. So, I didn't understand why they did that, by the way, until I had my own kid. Like literally that day, I was like, I understand why they did it now. I would give it up for him. But they, you know, we had a lot of conversations, and I think the important thing is to maintain transparency and be really open with your family if you're going into any kind of reunion situation, because I always kept them informed and I always kept their emotions like in the back of my mind. But they had always encouraged me to, when I had the inclination to search, that they would help me however they could, and they wanted to be a part of it. And sure enough, before I met either of my birth parents, I reunited with my extended birth family, because my birth mother was also a adopted. And so through DNA, I found her birth family. So I found like my maternal grandparents and uncles and cousins and all of that.
Long lost family, season 5, episode 2. You gotta watch.
I found so many people. And my mom and dad were there the day that I went out to Syracuse and went. There was a big family reunion for my maternal grandparents' side of the family. And I met 50 people who looked like me, and including my grandfather's brother, my uncle Rudy, who I got to meet him before he passed. He was in his 80s and he had been through the war with my grandfather and his other brothers. And so getting to learn and add grandparents and adding all these people into your life, it doesn't replace anything. Your sure. heart is kind of like the Grinch's heart. It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's like when people are like, which one of your kids do you love more? And people have trouble with that. I only have one kid, so it's easy, but
sure.
I don't think you have to have a favorite and you don't have to, like, your family can all live in your heart. That's the cheesiest, most hallmark thing I'll say.
I love it. Your family, no, I love it. That's awesome. You have
room for everyone.
I gotta, of course, pay the bills here and talk about our sponsors and stuff. But real quick, before we do this, we're going to end up in the friend zone where somebody gets to ask you a question from patreon.com/kindoffunny.
All right.
But before that, what did you name your son, by the way?
Clark.
You're the best. You're the best. Ladies and gentlemen, of course.
You love Spider-Man, though. All the pictures are Spider-Man.
He'll come around.
I've tried.
Don't
worry.
How old is he now?
6.
Oh, don't worry. He'll be fine. He'll get there. You know what I mean?
He told other people at school that his name was Peter. And one of the parents like said to my wife at one point, she's like, oh, you're Peter's mom. And my wife had to be like, actually, his name's Clark, but he's that into Peter Parker. So
that cuts deep. That cuts
it does. It does. But you know what? I love that he loves anything that my son loves. I love so much.
You know what I mean?
Spider-Man's great. Yeah.
He could want to go drive John Deere tractors all day long. He likes superheroes. That's good enough. We'll take it as a win.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is We Have Cool Friends, of course, our podcast show where we interview our cool friends. You can get it on youtube.com/kindoffunny. Podcast services around the globe. No matter where you get it, please like, subscribe, share. Thank you to our Patreon producer, Mohammed, of course, Momo, went over to patreon.com/kindoffunny. Just like you can to support the show, get your name read, get the show ad-free, and have a good time. Also, of course, like I said, you get it ad-free. Who are our ads this week? Well, thanks for asking, everybody. Number one is HelloFresh. Get fresh, pre-measured ingredients and mouthwatering seasonal recipes delivered right to your door with HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. HelloFresh lets you skip the trips to the grocery store and makes home cooking fun, easy, and affordable. How do we know? Well, I've used HelloFresh before, but right now, the one and only Tim Gettys and Gia Tapp Harris are using HelloFresh to make delicious burgers. I saw them making some ribs the other day. I think they did some ahi tuna as well. HelloFresh offers so many recipes to choose from each week to help you break out of your recipe rut. There's something for everyone, including low-calorie, vegetarian, and family-friendly recipes each and every week. Over 90% of ingredients are sourced directly from growers to ensure the freshest recipes are delivered right to you. Of course, you get to save time. You go on the app, you pick out what you want. It's contactless, delivered to your doorstep, making it easy. As I've talked about before, pre-portioned ingredients, you got the instructions right there. You go, you make the thing, you feel like you're being a big old Emeril Lagasse. You know what I mean? Bam! I don't think he's ever been... Emeril Lagasse is not affiliated with HelloFresh in any way, but I threw him in there. Bam. HelloFresh, of course, is also giving back. They're committed to making fresh, delicious food available now more than ever, and have taken extra steps to make sure you can get it. Everybody, you should go to HelloFresh.com/80morning and use the code 80morning to get a total of $80 off, including free shipping on your first box. Additional restrictions apply. Please visit HelloFresh.com for more details. Again, HelloFresh.com/80morning for 80% off, or $80 off, sorry. Our next sponsor is Honey. You've heard me talk about Honey because I use it all the time and love it. What is Honey? Well, are you shopping online? Of course you are. You're watching this online or listening online, or somehow online is involved with getting this product. So you've got to be buying something online. What you do with Honey is you go on your Google Chrome. You go to the Honey website here. Of course, honey.com/morning. When you go there, you download the extension. It installs into your Google Chrome browser, and you got this little H over here right up above the message bar. Then when you go and you check out places like TeePublic, like over on Amazon, like over on all sorts of websites, Honey goes, hold on a second, and this little dancing coin pops up, and he runs promo codes when you check out, trying to find you the best code. If you saw me last night, I was talking about using Shudder, the horror TV service, the streaming service. Guess what? I went to Shudder. I signed up last night. Honey had me a code. And on top of that, since I'm logged in, I'm earning Honey coins that I can then use for gift cards later on. Honey is great. You should use Honey. I talk about it all the time for real because it's awesome. If you don't already use Honey, you could be missing out on free savings. It's literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid and supporting this podcast. Get Honey for free over at joinhoney.com/morning. That's joinhoney.com/morning. And then our final sponsor of the day, it's Hims. You've heard us talk about 4hims.com for a long time, ladies and gentlemen, because Nick and Andy use it to treat their hair loss. They noticed thinning hair. They went to 4hims.com, a one-stop shop for skincare, sexual wellness, and hair. And guess what? They talked to a doctor. The doctor looked into what they needed, gave them a generic well-known or generic equivalents to well-known prescriptions so that they could save money, get it delivered right to the door discreetly. We've talked about this a lot, ladies and gentlemen. One of the reasons 4hims.com got founded is because guess what? A lot of us don't want to go to the doctor. We're embarrassed by what might send us there, like erectile dysfunction, but there's nothing to be embarrassed about. So you can have these conversations online. You don't have to worry about it. You talk right to the doctor. There's no waiting room. There's no fitting into your schedule. You got 15 minutes. You go, you set it up, you go there, you do it. Then, like I said, they send you the stuff if you meet a bunch of requirements, of course, because it is FDA approved. And then they send it to your door. It's unmarked. You get the pills you need. You don't have to feel embarrassed. And it's great. And you shouldn't be embarrassed. Try Hims today by starting out with a free online visit. Go to 4hims.com/KFMS. That's FORHIMS.com/KFMS. 4hims.com/KFMS. Prescription products are subject to a medical provider approval and require an online consultation with a medical provider who will determine if the prescription is appropriate. See the website for full details and safety information. This could cost hundreds if you went in person to the doctor or pharmacy. Remember, that's 4hims.com/KFMS. All right, Sean, we're back to you. And now we're entering the friend zone, of course, where people on patreon.com/kindoffunny can ask you questions to do that. The first one's just going to come from me because I missed it earlier and I screwed up. Heart attack. How many issues is this going to go for? Like, do you have an end in sight? Are you down to do it forever? Like, how does that work for you?
We're going to go for at least 12 issues. Okay. So we have, this first volume is now being collected, and then over the next couple of months, we'll be announcing when volume two is going to kick off. But definitely it ends on a cliffhanger, folks. I'm not going to leave you hanging forever. That would just be cruel. Sure.
It's that thing I want to know. And then I also always wonder with comics, you know, like if, you know, I think Skybound in particular is good at partnering up with stuff that does have an end. Like, hey, here's my story to tell. Right. And then letting it go. So I know I was wondering how that shook out for you.
Okay. That's for sure. One of like the best things actually about it is just, I think by the time that we started working with Eric, we already had issues 1 through 6 completely written.
Nice.
And I wrote, you know, the rest of them, and he's been drawing. So by the time the book debuted, we were already into volume two. And that's just, it's not common in comics to get that kind of runway. So always grateful to Skybound for that.
Yeah. And then I guess the other thing I want to compliment you on that I haven't, because I actually haven't talked to you about the book, is number one, like I love it. What I really dig about it is the issues that end with articles. You do a great job of ending on articles, blog posts, you know, your fake Wikipedia that give so much context to the world in a way that it's like, oh man, you've really thought all this through. Again, I think it evolves as it goes, but to have all that background, because when people say something or reference the Great Pandemic or whatever, to then have information about it is great. Do you have like a Bible that you've already written, or is it all upstairs?
No, I wrote a 70-page Bible like really early on. I'm a crazy person. I remember sending it to Sean Makowitz, and he was like, "Bro, this is like TV series level Bible." And I was like, "That's what you get, Peterson." Yeah, that's what you get. And I did. I had actually, I gotta say, I had like from being at DC, I had a lot of access to like TV scripts, TV series Bibles and stuff like that. And so that's kind of where I modeled my comics pitches were more after like TV pitches and stuff like that. But yeah, I have a whole big thing worked out, and the way that it came to be was just like trying to find a logical explanation for the things that I wanted to have and have it all feel really grounded and tethered. And so I actually like worked out beat for beat what like the future history would be. Nice. And then not put a lot of dates into the book so that it would hold up over time, but to give it some sense of structure and be able to recall a past that everybody collectively knew about in that world.
That's awesome. Your friend zone question comes from the one and only Brandon Jackson Shorts, who wrote into patreon.com/kindoffunny and says, "Hey, Greg and Sean, I've always been curious, how much input did the Injustice 2 video game have on the comic? Did you guys collaborate with Tom Taylor at all? And vice versa. Did he have any say in the game story since he spent so much time writing in the world? Thanks for your time. You rock, Brandon Jackson Shorts.
That's a great question. Thank you, Brandon. The best way to put it is that by the time a story mode is developed enough for a comic book writer to come in, and this was the case for me on the Mortal Kombat comics as well as for Tom on Injustice 1 and 2, the story mode script is usually done and locked so that the writer for the comics and everyone else can work from the same like basic lore to have that template. But I would say that, you know, with Injustice 2, there's certainly efforts made to incorporate things that happen, especially in the intro dialogue, to make sure that readers know that the books and the games are in the same continuity. There are also a couple of differences that I'm sure sharp-eyed fans will be like, where was Night?
Dead.
Where was Nightwing in the Arkham sequence in the beginning? He should have been there in the prologue. And yeah, I agree. I wish we could have had the budget for a Dick Grayson Nightwing of appropriate age to be there, and Red Robin too. I wish we could have all the characters, but that's why it was budget. So everything is canon, and everything that Tom did in, I think, the Injustice books, look, called attention to what we needed to do, which was carry on the story, but not retell the story of the first game in any way, but expand this world, dig deeper. If anything, you know, the decision not to go with a multiverse was in a lot of ways supported by the fact that Tom had told so many great stories just within the universe without introducing the multiverse in the comics.
Yeah.
It said, hey, this is rich enough. We don't need the primary DC characters. We could just live in the Injustice world, and that's enough for people.
Beautiful. Sean, thank you for being one of our cool friends.
Thank you for being a cool friend. The feeling's mutual.
Heart Attack, of course, like we were saying, out now digitally. You can get it in comic stores. You can get it at bookstores tomorrow, volume 1.
It's so beautiful.
It's very beautiful. Yeah, we didn't even talk about the art. I always feel bad about that when I talk to comic writers.
Eric Spotsky, my co-creator, like, what a genius. Like, that dude can draw. This is actually the sequence you were talking about in Austin.
Yeah.
That dude can draw anything. And I'm especially proud, I will say, I got to give him the extra shout out. Like, Eric draws a conversation like nobody else, in that when he draws like characters just in dialogue, he thinks about the space in a way, and he thinks about the nuance and the emotion on their faces in a way that I think few can master and match. In as far as like, I would give him, this is a good comic geek note.
Please do.
I would give him scripts that are like calling for 6 or 8 panel pages, and he would turn them into 12 to 16 panel pages. And the trick is, don't give your artists 16 panel pages on every page. They'll hate you for it.
Yeah. Let them find it.
If you find an artist, you always give them the freedom. Say, hey, if you can see this better than me, consider all of my breakdowns merely suggestions, and the dialogue is, and the action and the emotion are what count more than anything. And when you let an artist like Eric go wild, that's how you get the best book, I think.
That's awesome. Outside of that, where can people keep up with you?
I'm at Kittleson on Twitter intermittently. But I would also tell you to check out Skybound Games and follow Skybound Games. Skybound, I'm the creative director for their games team. And I am very excited about some of the stuff that's coming up from Skybound. So that's all I can say, though.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough.
I can't spill the tea yet, but there's some dank tea to spill. We'll spill it soon.
Well, I look forward to hearing all about it at E3 that never ends and just goes on and on. I know. And on. In December, it'll still be E3.
It's the year that E3 never ended, not the year 3 that have never happened.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been We Have Cool Friends. We'll be back next Monday with a very special episode. I actually got to do, I was the moderator over on an allyship panel for the IGDA the other day at their fundraiser, where they're trying to raise money, obviously, to help minority developers out. So I moderate a conversation with Khalif Adams from Spawn On Me, Steven Spawn from Able Gamers, Elaine Gomez from Latinx in Gaming, Shanae Bryant from Crystal Dynamics, and Elise Willems from Funhouse. That will be our We Have Cool Friends next week. So a very meaty panel dealing with more serious issues, as we love to here.
This is an all-star panel.
I know, right?
Social Avengers.
I know. Social justice warriors.
Hey, we wear it with pride.
I do. Hey, man, if you like Superman as much as me and Sean, yeah, you're not afraid of that terminology.
Nope.
Sean, thank you for all your time.
Thank you, Greg.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for watching. Until next time, it's been our pleasure to serve you.